time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for December 7th, 2019. As we count down to the holiday giving days, Hanukkah beginning on the 22nd, Christmas the 25th, and Kwanzaa the 26th, I thought it would be a good time to chat with World Bicycle Relief's co-founder, Leah Misbach-Day. World Bicycle Relief, founded in 2005 after the devastating tsunami in Sri Lanka, is one of the most successful charitable organizations in our bicycle world today. Its vision is to supply bicycles to help students, healthcare workers, and small business owners travel to and from their respective destinations. That effort has resulted in 487,000 bikes delivered and 2.5 million lives positively impacted. The original Buffalo bike is also about to undergo a new iteration as World Bicycle Relief ramps up to bring its vision to South America. Leah will be with me in a moment. After we talk with Leah, we're going to head out to Des Moines, Iowa, to meet the new ride director for RAGBRAI. Dieter Drake has a long history of successful events in his back pocket, and he's looking forward to taking the reins of this iconic event as it prepares to launch for 2020. And finally, Pedal Power Promoters Christine Acosta caught up with Vision Zero's Leah Shaham, yes, we have two Leahs on the show this week, at the Vision Zero Cities Conference in New York City in October. Christine talks with Leah about what Vision Zero is doing, how certain cities are adapting Vision Zero principles with great success, and the grim facts of what happens when we don't address the issues of traffic, equity, and public health. So first, it's off to Chicago to speak with World Bicycle Relief's Leah Misbach-Day. Hi, Leah. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's time to talk about WBR, World Bicycle Relief. How are you?
Oh, I'm so good, Diane. Thanks for reconnecting with us. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, you know, I'm always reminded when I get my little World Bicycle Relief packet right before the holidays, and I'm like, you know what, I need to talk to Leah and see how things are going. And I assume they're going well?
Oh, it's so exciting. World Bicycle Relief's 14 years old, so I feel like we're in our teen years, which means, you know, we're ever so energetic and, you know, optimistic. I guess for your new listeners, I'd like to say that World Bicycle Relief is designed and we execute programs to mobilize people through the power of bicycles. These are people living in rural, developing countries, and we're committed to helping people conquer this challenge of distance and achieve independence and thrive. And what that means is getting people to school, to continue access to healthcare, and to, you know, make their ways to and from their livelihoods just that much easier.
Are most of your bicycles delivered on the African continent?
They are. We started in Sri Lanka, and
oh yes, I remember that.
The main program we have today is in southern and eastern Africa. Actually, we have a country in Western Africa too, but we're excited to open up our footprint in Colombia too this next year. That's the big news coming.
Hmm. Who knew?
Yes.
See, now you even gave me a surprise. That's awesome. Well, I know the goal is 500,000 bicycles. Where are we in that goal?
Oh, gosh. Well, we just had our Giving Tuesday efforts, and we set out a goal of 500 supporters contributing yesterday, which we reached in reflection of this 500,000 bike goal. I feel like it's such a big number 500,000 bikes is sort of hard for our brains to imagine. But if you lined up a Buffalo bicycle side by side and row by row, you would fill 105 football fields with bicycles.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Leah Misbach-Day. She is the co-founder of World Bicycle Relief. She's also a photographer, which we might talk about if we have time, because I love photography. But one of the questions I wanted to ask so that we can clarify for people who don't know is what the Buffalo bike is. It is a very specific bike.
Buffalo bike is a very specific bicycle. It's a steel horse. We like to affectionately call it 50 pounds of love. It's heavy. It's a single speed. It has a robust rack on the back for carrying people or 50 kgs of produce or grain or fuel. And it's kind of an interesting shape in that it's gender neutral. We used to have a step-through bike for the ladies and a double crossbar bicycle for the gents. And we would always ask recipients, even the ladies or the men, which bike they would prefer. And oftentimes the ladies would choose the gents bike rather than the step through, even though they wear long dresses, tanky dresses. And we thought that was interesting. But they would ride them anyway, even though it was much more difficult with their style of dress. But I think they also wanted the gents bike so that their husband could ride it and borrow it and have a dignified bicycle for a male. Well, that wasn't actually in Mr. Day's agenda when redesigning the bike with a curved top tube. Today, as it turns out, that gender question is off the table. Our bikes are gender neutral. And the beauty of this design is that we can ship more in a container. So it solves a lot of problems with this very specific single bicycle shape.
Very interesting. Where are these bikes actually built?
So the bikes are assembled where we distribute. There's product development and product design in both Chicago and Taiwan, and the parts are shipped from China. Giant is our frame manufacturer, and then we have several component companies that we work with. And so they're shipped in CKD form to Zambia, Zimbabwe, Kenya, Malawi, Ghana, and now soon, Colombia. And there we have assembly plants where we hire assemblers lovingly and with skill put together the bicycles for distribution.
Nice. Well, I'm on the website right now, and you are getting pretty darn close to that 500,000. It's 487,000 delivered. 2.5 million lives changed. 134,000 global supporters. It's just amazing how it's grown since the first time I spoke with you, however many years ago that was. That's so awesome. One of the things I'd like to do, beside these statistics, is to ask you to tell our listeners the story about one of the recipients. I know you have so many stories, but if you would choose one for us, just to sort of illustrate how important these bikes are to these people.
Oh, gosh. I have so many stories. You may know a couple winters ago, we lived in Kenya for 7 months. And as a photographer, this was fabulous because I could meet people and I could revisit them time and time again. And I got to know all kinds of wonderful, we call them end users, recipients of Buffalo bicycles. But I'd love to tell you a story about Stella because she's sort of exemplary of a lot of girls in rural Africa. And when I met Stella, she was in school and thriving. And she's 19 years old, a sophomore in high school. She always knew that she wanted an education because in her area, it's a sugarcane plantation area where all the people do for work is work for the sugarcane industry. And she knew that if she didn't get her education, her future would look like one of a cane cutter or a weed puller. And that is, you know, unskilled labor, hard labor in hot sun all day. And she just knew that that isn't what she wanted to do. Now, keep in mind, Stella's commute to and from school is 12 kilometers each way. That's about 7 miles. It takes 2 hours each way, each day walking. But she did it. And she would, like all of her other girls her age, she would get up at 4:35 in the morning, do her long list of chores, fetching water, fetching firewood, making the fire, making the breakfast, sweeping the grounds, starting the laundry, caring for the children. I mean, this is what all the older girls in families do every morning. And some of them don't set off for school because there's just so many chores to do and they were so far from the school. But Stella was determined to do both. And sometimes she would arrive at school late. And now, I want to tell you about this little side story about what it's like to be late for a girl in these schools. The head teachers are tough. They are hardcore. If a child, boy or girl, gets to school late, they say, oh, no. You cannot come into class now. I want you to go out back and weed the garden or pick the cotton or pick the tomatoes if they're growing things. They certainly aren't let into class. Or they go in the back and clean the latrines or sweep the hallways. They might get a wrapping on their knuckles or backside. And worst of all, Diane, is they're sometimes turned away. After they walk to school two hours and they're late, they're turned away. So all of this is like humiliating to teenagers, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And so Stella really worked hard to go to school, get to school on time and do all of her responsibilities. But as it turned out, she got pregnant. It's not always safe on these roads, these long walks to school. And she had to drop out. She stayed home for 2 years, took care of her baby, and then she got up this courage to ask her parents if she could return to school. Now, this is kind of another big thing for children to do. They don't usually ask their parents for ideas about their future. They just do what they're told to do. And so Stella says, you know, please, please, Mom and Dad, I want to go back to school. I'll make you proud. And they says, well, do well, and we'll take care of your daughter. So this is great. So now Stella gets up, still does her chores, sets off for school. And around about this same time, the bicycles came to her school. And so now Stella was thrilled. She's got the tool. She's got the initiative. And so as I told you, I met her when she was a sophomore. Not only is she doing all of this, but she's now secretary of the sports club. Last time I saw her, she was starting up a little business at home, fetching water for the neighbors so she could get a little extra money. And I asked her more about her dreams. Well, I'm here to tell you, they are well beyond a cane cutter and a weed puller. She told me, she says, Leah, I want to be a diplomat. Now, I've learned a lot of things before, and this is where Stella is unique. I said, diplomat? Tell me more about your goal to be a diplomat. And she says, you know, I want to go outside of my country and represent Kenya. Now, honestly, this was a worldview. This is so far from being a weed puller and a cane cutter. It was just astonishingly inspiring.
And how is she doing? Do we know?
Yeah, well, I think she's doing really well. I intend to go back and visit her soon and see, because she should be graduating by about now.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Leah Misbach-Day. She is the co-founder of World Bicycle Relief. This is the time of year when we try to talk to listeners about the opportunities for charitable giving if they're interested in doing something in the world of bicycles. And this is World Bicycle Relief, so it really has a very broad view. I want to wrap it up with just a couple more quick things, and that is, what are your goals in Colombia? Now, Colombia's got some real issues. South America has some real issues. Who do you hope to reach down there?
So that's a great question. In Colombia, it's a really interesting country, and the country is pro-education in such a way that they've decided that all children should be allowed access to school. And this is one of our specialities, access to school, especially in rural settings. In Colombia, there's lots of plantation situations, a bit like Stella's. You know, there's pineapple fields, banana fields, sugarcane fields, and lots of rural people work in these industries. And the transportation to and from school for these girls oftentimes is these buses that also take the plantation workers. And if it's harvest season, the students have to go early in the morning with the agricultural workers. And then they have to wait at school until dark to go home with these same people on that same bus. So they have these super long days in school that aren't productive for the family and aren't productive for the kids. We're working with the Ministry of Education and identifying schools in some of these poor areas. And currently, we have to work where it's a little bit flatter. As you know, Columbia is kind of hilly.
Right.
But here's the other exciting part about World by Square Leaf. We have four brilliant engineers that are working on adding gear, a gear or two, to the Buffalo bicycle.
Nice.
They have these very innovative ways of thinking. And because you want to keep the price low, the quality high, and continue to serve those at the bottom of the market, which is rare for product development in any arena.
I guess it didn't occur to me that the bikes you've delivered so far are single speed, and that's adequate for the terrain. Going to Columbia, that would be inadequate, and now you have to rethink the gearing. That is interesting. And I'd like to say, I'm interested in what you come up with or what your engineers come up with. That'll be really interesting.
Yeah, stay tuned. It keeps them up at night.
Yeah, so I'll bet it does.
Lots of things are happening.
I'll bet it does. Well, Leah, tell our listeners how they can find out more about World Bicycle Relief, and if they're interested, make a donation.
Okay. Please do go to worldbicyclerelief.org. Check out our brand new website, which we're really excited about. Explore any area of interest you find there. But please, please give. All your money will be matched. And the impact is tremendous and much appreciated.
Well, you do great work with WBR, and we follow it pretty much all year, but this is the time of year where I know it makes a difference to the organization because people are looking at offering year-end giving, and I hope they'll take a look at WBR. Thank you so much for talking with me. I hope you and FK have a great holiday and keep up the great work.
Diane, you're an amazing advocate. Thank you, too.
Thank
you. Happy holidays.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Leah Misbach-Day joined me to talk about World Bicycle Relief and the work it's doing. As Leah and I chatted right after our recorded interview, she was reminded that they recently conducted a random control survey of 8,000 students and found that there was a 68% improvement in punctuality when a bicycle became the means for the children to get to school. So if you're interested in learning more about World Bicycle Relief, or you wish to make a donation at this holiday giving time, you can log on to worldbicyclerelief.org. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll mosey on out to Des Moines, Iowa, to chat with RAGRI's new director, Dieter Drake. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Last year, there was quite a dust-up in the RAGBRAI ranks, and longtime ride director T.J. Juskiewicz, as well as his staff, resigned over a disagreement with the iconic ride's sponsor, the Des Moines Register. The search for a new ride director came to a successful conclusion when the Register announced its choice of Dieter Drake this past week. I caught up with Dieter even before he had a chance to set up his email. Hi, Dieter. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks, Diane. Appreciate it.
This is pretty exciting because there was some unsettling news about RAGBRAI last year, but they have brought you on. You have an unbelievably long and successful history doing rides and events, and you've taken the reins. So 2020 is the 48th year of the event, as I am calculating. Is that correct?
It is. It's almost as old as I am, Diane. So yes, this is our 48th year next July. So 2020 is it's going to be a great year for us.
It is, and it's a good. I like 2020. I think it's kind of a neat number. So tell
right.
my listeners a little bit about your background, where you come from, and I know now you're in Des Moines.
Right. Yeah. Sort of. I'm kind of back and forth between Colorado and Des Moines at the moment, but. Yeah, so I'm originally from upstate New York. Both my wife and I are from some small towns up outside of Albany. We both grew up there and met later when I was after college. In any case, so I was a competitive runner back there, back at Gilderman High School, way back. now. I can say way, way back now. It's not just way back. Right? So lots of fun. So I ended up at North Carolina State University in Raleigh and finished that degree. I got a degree in fisheries and wildlife science, of all things, and then went home and met my wife, Amy, and ended up going back to NC State to, believe it or not, get a mechanical engineering degree in 1998. So then we bounced around the country a little bit. We did end up back in that area in a little small town called Cambridge, New York, which is right near Saratoga Springs and kind of between Saratoga Springs and the Vermont state line. Very New Englandish small town, and got into cycling. My father was a cross-country, high school cross-country meet organizer, so I kind of grew up in that world, and I decided, okay, I can do this only on bikes. So I decided to start producing a cycling event or two in that little small town. And that's kind of how I got into organizing bicycle races. Of course, I was a cyclist already, but decided I wanted to produce something of my own. So I produced an event called the Balloon Festival Classic, a tiny little bicycle race at that time around a balloon festival that had been longstanding in the village of Cambridge. And I said, okay, that went well. And the next year I decided I'm going to organize another event called the Tour of the Baton Kill. And that event took off. It ended up being, by 2007 or 8, ended up being the largest sanctioned road bicycle race in the country. And by 2013, we had we had 3,400 racers from probably 48 states and 20 countries, which included a professional race. So we did that, and then right about at that time, the bicycle racing market kind of shifted and went down a little bit. And I got to become at that point more of a recreational bike rider. I wasn't interested in racing anymore, nor were my kids or most of my friends weren't interested in racing bicycles. So we decided, okay, we're going to shift over and do more fun rides and grand fondos and recreational tours and things like that. So right about that time, we switched everything over, including our events, into those kinds of events. And, it continues today. So 2016, we ended up moving out to Colorado because we wanted to change after being 14 years in upstate New York in the cold winters, as you probably are aware of in Ohio. We decided Colorado was more our speed. So at that time, we decided to move out there. And we've been out there since 2016, like I mentioned. In the last just few weeks, this opportunity with RagBri came about. Kind of a friend approached me and see if I was interested. And I said, boy, who wouldn't want to be part of this Great American Cycling ride? So I took the opportunity, and I've been in Iowa the last couple of days, meeting people, meeting clubs, meeting charter groups, meeting just cyclists that are passionate about RagBri. Of course, there's been a little bit of turmoil with it all. And, you know, it's kind of my job to calm things down a little bit, maybe just with my presence a little bit, to the extent that I possibly can, and bring some more stability back into the event and some confidence into the cycling community that this event is going to be great. It's going to be the 48th annual, like you mentioned, and we're going to have just as many people. It's going to have great stops, great pass through towns. It's going to have a great route, which we're excited to announce at the end of January, as we always do. And it's just going to be a great event. I'm really, really fortunate and excited to be part of this event.
So we're speaking with Dieter Drake. He is the new ride director for RagBri, the iconic across Iowa, west to east. It goes from the west coast to the Mississippi, as I remember. It's been many years since we did it. Yeah. You did talk about the fact that the numbers would be the same. As I remember, there is a lottery system that the RagBri uses. Is that true?
There is. Yeah, it's been that way, I think, for a long, long time. It's a lottery system. And that opened up, I believe, on November 15th before I got here. But I was kind of aware of it, obviously. So that lottery is in place, and that number is growing. And the rates, as I understand it, in terms of registration for that lottery are consistent with what they were in previous years. So that's a good story to tell. And officially, April 1st is when the lottery, the winners for the applicants on the lottery actually get into the event.
I didn't remember the whole timeline. I just remembered something about the lottery opening and then it closes. So one of the things that always happens at RagBri is you get people who glom onto the event, whether they have their wristbands or not. You end up with not 8,000 people on the road, but like 20,000 people on the road. I assume you have expectations of that happening still?
Of course, yeah. That's kind of the black market of RagBri, for lack of a better term. People come out and ride the event, and they don't have a wristband. They kind of they benefit from, you know, all the support and all the excitement of it. And then, you know, that, what a great problem to have, right?
Right.
More people out on bikes for your event. So I think that's been a kind of a fun part of it, honestly. What we're going to do, I think, going forward is probably offer some of those folks that typically wouldn't have done paid a registration fee in the past, maybe make the 1 day pass more attractive to that crowd, and to provide more opportunity for those folks to directly engage with the event and also receive some of the more support that the registered riders do. So look for more detail on that probably coming out in the next 30 days or so.
Oh, cool. Very, very cool. So as I remember, there are some iconic stops along the way. We have like Mr. Pork Chop, and we have the turkey guy with the giant turkey drumsticks. I don't know how they grow these pork chops and these pigs and these turkeys this big, but I assume all of those people will be in place.
Oh, of course. I met Matt with Mr. Pork Chop on Sunday. We had a kind of an open house at a brewery up the road in Mason City, which was well attended. We probably had 80, 85 people in the room at one time, and Matt was one of those folks, and we chatted for a long time over a beer about his company, and he's so excited to be part of this event again. So look for those same, none of that's going to change. Those same people are going to be out there. The same culture of rag ride that's been in existence for decades is going to be maintained.
So what do you see as your biggest challenge taking over this event now?
Yeah, really introductions to say, look, here I am, and here's our great staff. We've got some really great people that are still involved, that have been involved with the event since forever. And I'm the new guy, obviously, so I'm going to get out and meet some people. We definitely have a route announcement that we have to maintain on the 25th, 26th of January at the Iowa Bike Expo here in town in Des Moines. So that's on our minds. In fact, that's going to be at the top of a little dry erase board that I am out here shortly. We've got this date, we've got to commit to it, and we've got some things to do. So that's really on our minds. Obviously, the route we have to select before that, meeting with all the stakeholders, the clubs, the charters, the riders, the state patrol, the EMS, the state DOT, and all the towns. Obviously, the towns have a vested interest in making this event go well. So we need to make sure that, you know, that we're doing the right things, we're communicating at the right level and the right content for those folks to be able to make a value decision as to what they need to do once they get selected, what they need to do to prepare for 15 or 20,000 people coming through town on a Tuesday or Wednesday, you know, for example.
Right.
So that's a big ask for a lot of those folks. So I'm going to reach out to those folks to make sure that they have what they need to make their decisions.
Well, I remember going through these towns, even though they swelled from whatever they were, tiny little towns, to this massive city each day. And the townspeople looked so forward to RagBri coming through. I know it's a huge economic boom for them. And they just turn out in droves with things like, I can remember riding through one town and the fire department had taken a hose and poked holes in it.
Right.
And so you'd ride under this kind of mist in this 98 degree day. I mean, just
perfect.
Little things that were just so nice to see. Yeah.
So many people care about the event. They care about the rider more than that. They want to be part of it. Yes. They want to reap the benefits of the economic impact for not only the town, but the vendors that they have here. So they want to be part of it. They want it to be a safe event. So what you described is consistent with some of the things that I've been reading. I've actually been literally right in front of me right now. I've got some of the pass-through town surveys that came back from 2019. So I've been going through those, and there's a bunch, and I'm mostly very, very positive. Some concerns about this or that, and those are definitely on my, I've already written those things down to make sure that we address those things going forward, whether or not we pass through that town, that particular town or not. But some just incredible feedback. There's an article that I got from the town of Salem. Oh, I'm sorry, the Mount Pleasant News. So yes, the town of Salem, just a story about a couple that, I'm sorry, a gentleman that had an injury when he was very younger. So he turned to cycling as kind of therapy. And that was 35, 40 years ago. And here he is participating in the event, and it goes through his small town. So it's on the front page of the Mount Pleasant News. Those kinds of stories are just golden. So, you know, that's the kind of story that I really like to broadcast to these towns. They really turn out. I'm just looking at the front page picture. There's probably 6,000 bikes sitting here.
Right.
And just an incredible story that, you know, those kinds of things that we want to get out and say, hey, this is RagBri, not only to people in Iowa, which is our principal focus, but, you know, trying to bring new people into the event that may not have participated in it before is also really important. So sharing those stories is an important piece of that.
Well, I'll share two quick ones with you. One is every single day, this young lady, I don't know how old she was, I'd say maybe she was in her early 30s, rode a hand cycle. She had no use of her legs, and I never saw her. She rode every single mile, but I never saw her without a just ear-to-ear grin on her face. She was just so happy to be there. That was one of my favorite things. Uphill, downhill, it didn't matter. But the other is I know two people who met their future spouses at Ragbri. And,
oh, I've heard stories.
And we're talking 1999, and they're all still married today. So
Not only that, I've heard about marriages and wedding ceremonies during Ragbri.
Why not?
What a great – why not, exactly? So they get married in front of Elvis in Vegas, and they get married in front of bikes in Ragbri.
And love what it. Could be better than getting married on your bike? I love it. I love it. I don't want to keep you. I know you are really, really busy and that things are starting to come together. I do have one controversial thing to ask you, and that is the guy who was the race director before you, I think it's JT is what they call him, had said he's going to put on a competing ride with the same week. First of all, I think it's probably not a great idea. But second of all, is it going to happen? Is that what he's still planning to do? Do you know?
Yeah, I actually met TJ. It's actually TJ. Ride director. Yeah, and at that event up in Mason City, and we chatted briefly and said hello, which was very nice. His event actually got shifted to the week prior, so there's or maybe not exactly the week prior, but I don't know the exact date. But it's one of the weeks prior to Ragbri now, so it's not on the same week. So we're happy about that very much. We don't want riders competing and choosing. You know, my perspective and position is what a great problem to have, again, for Iowa. More people on bikes, more visibility to the public. I think that benefits everybody. So
good.
So that's not terribly controversial. Maybe not as controversial as it was. I know there was some tension there, but I think that's generally the position, that bicycling in Iowa is an important thing, and we're excited to not only produce our event but to see other people out on the road.
Well, let's let my listeners know if they don't know already, although most people who listen to this show either have done Ragbri or they're going to do Ragbri. It's on their bucket list, but give them the information and let's give them a couple of the deadlines that are coming up.
Right. So ragbri.com, obviously RAGBRAI.com is the website. You can register. You can sign up to be part of the forum there. It's just a wonderful opportunity to engage with the event and see what's going on, not only with Ragbri, but things around the state, some of the towns we've been to in the past, and just some of the experiences that on the forum in particular that people are sharing about, again, their stories, just like your stories. They have other, 10 other stories that they can describe on the forum. So that's a great way to engage with Ragbri. You can register there, like I mentioned, either the day pass or the full week as a club or an individual or a team or an individual. So ragbri.com on the end of January is the announcement party here in Des Moines. I believe it's the 25th, if I have that right. And Saturday, so right here in Des Moines at the convention center across the street from where I'm sitting now. So that's an exciting thing. Like I mentioned, April 1st is the deadline for the lottery, like we talked about. So you need to get your name in by April 1st, and June 1st is the deadline for the one-day pass. Those are kind of the critical dates, and we're excited to have another 15,000 to 20,000 people out here in July.
Yeah, it will be fun. We've been speaking with Dieter Drake. He is the new ride director for Ragbri, the iconic Ragbri. It'll be year number 48. It's ragbri.com. Thank you so much for talking with me. I wish you a lot of luck this year.
Excellent. Thank you, Diane. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Dieter Drake joined me from his new office at Ragbri headquarters. As he mentioned, the lottery for the ride is open if you're interested in participating in the 2020 event. You can log on to ragbri.com for all the details. So let's take a break, and when we come back, you'll hear Christine Acosta's interview with Vision Zero's founder and director, Leah Shaham. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Christine Acosta, the founder of pedal-powered promoters in Florida, journeyed up to New York City in October to attend the Vision Zero Cities Conference. There, she was able to get a chance to talk with Vision Zero's founder and director, Leah Shaham.
I'm Christine Acosta with Pedal Power Promoters, and I'm just super excited to be here talking with Leah Shaham with Vision Zero Network. Could you start, Leah, please, just by introducing yourself and reiterate for listeners who might not be familiar with Vision Zero Network what it is that you're doing?
I'm so excited to be here, too. Thank you for the opportunity. So the Vision Zero Network is a nonprofit working across the U.S. to promote the goal of Vision Zero, or zero traffic deaths or severe injuries among all road users. And we're working with now more than 45 communities that have committed to the goal of Vision Zero, which is big change. I know we'll talk about that. So I'm really excited. I have a fun role of working with people like you, Christine, people in the public sector, the private sector, the advocacy world, to really help figure out what works to move to zero and ensure safety for everyone.
How long has Vision Zero been around? Because when you said, what did you just say, 25 communities?
45.
45 communities. That's a huge number in such a short time. So tell us about that short window of launch, if you will.
It really is a relatively short window. So the idea of Vision Zero started just over 20 years ago in Sweden, and they've made tremendous progress there. Here in the U.S., we've been at it just about 5 years, and it started slowly with New York City being the first American city, then San Francisco, where I live, became the second city, then Washington, D.C., and it's grown and grown really quickly. So just in 5 years, we've moved from zero to 45 communities committing to Vision Zero, which is really fast change for an issue like this. And let me be the first to say, you know, saying they're committing to Vision Zero doesn't mean they're there. It doesn't mean, you know, they can check all the boxes and say they're done. It's just the first step in a long road to change. But it is a really important step because it's setting up a different mindset and a different approach. When you have your mayor or city manager and police chief and transportation director out there publicly, officially saying, we can't keep doing business as usual. Things need to change. A lot of times what they're saying is, hey, enough is enough of these preventable deaths and severe injuries on our roads. We have to do things differently. And Vision Zero is a different way to do it. So it's a really important acknowledgement of the problem and a strong and public and very measurable commitment from electeds and from people, frankly, with influence to help change the system and change the way we're doing this work so that we can ensure safe mobility. So it's a big shift we've seen in 5 years. I'm really encouraged, and I'll say I'm really impressed with and proud of the folks who've been committing. It's, again, people in positions of power like mayors and police chiefs, et cetera, and also amazing advocates like yourself. You know, we wouldn't be where we are if folks ranging from New York City to Seattle to Tampa, Florida to Durham, North Carolina, regular folks like us weren't out there saying, hey, we need to do things differently, and frankly, putting pressure and encouragement on their elected leaders and their decision makers.
When I've had the opportunity to hear the Families for Safe Streets, can you tell us a little bit about their role in the Vision Zero pursuits?
Yeah, these are really big change makers. These are folks who have either been involved in serious crashes and suffered themselves or lost a loved one, unfortunately, to traffic violence. So what we're seeing is these folks come together and really use their voices and honestly convert their anguish or turn their anguish into advocacy and into change. And I really want to commend the folks, again, in New York City who started this. About 5 years ago, the first Families for Safe Streets chapter started. And since then, I know of another 8 chapters across North America, from Texas to Oregon to California, two in California, to Virginia, to D.C., to Philadelphia, to Toronto up in Canada. And with all of these, again, it's really about people who are closest to this issue. They've been impacted deeply, personally, in a life-changing, altering, often tragic way. And again, they're really putting their voices to the political advocacy. I think the best example I've seen, again, is in New York City, where advocates have been traveling from New York City up to the state capitol in Albany over and over and over again in the last 5 years. They've teamed up with the city staff, and they've successfully won huge changes. Some of those changes include lowering the speed limit citywide in New York from 30 to 25 miles per hour, adding hundreds of cameras, speed cameras or safety cameras, we call them, around school area zones to protect people walking. And they're advocating for safer streets in all these and other ways. And what they've seen in this 5 years in New York City, actually this stat is for the first 4 years. So in the first 4 years in New York City, they've seen a 30% drop in traffic fatalities. It's dramatic. And I don't think they would have that success without the Families for Safe Streets advocating.
We get two kinds of feedback about New York. We get a lot of people who say, well, my city, my town, my community is no New York. So I want you to touch on that. But I also want to commend New York because they have done a lot of good emblems and encouragement to the general public and to their taxi and Uber and Lyft drivers, so that when visitors go to New York, we also see Vision Zero messaging. So can you talk about those two things from the perspective of New York?
Yeah, first I do want to give them credit also, because to go first with such a bold goal like this is a big deal. Somebody has to go first, right? And I think they're seeing the success they are with that 30% decrease in traffic deaths. And let me just pause and say, there are not fewer people in New York City. There are not fewer trips. This is amazing. As more people are living there, more people are moving around, they're actually seeing safer conditions. So I think it's a great and very encouraging model for all of us. Why are they seeing that? It's because they're really putting their money where their mouth is, literally. They're putting more budget towards safety. They are doing ambitious programs, like I said, around lowering speed limits and adding speed cameras. So they're encouraging good behavior by really having a carrot and stick, different carrot and sticks out there. The stick, of course, being camera enforcement. Hey, nobody wants to get a ticket. You know how you avoid a ticket? Don't travel over the speed limit. Don't drive unsafely. And then the carrots, I'd say, they're really investing in an amazing, better walking and biking environment. Things like transit. I don't want to forget transit. A great example, if you haven't heard yet, recently they turned 14th Street right in the heart of the city to a bus-only way. Now, walking and biking too, of course, but transit first street, and it's having great response. So they're really investing in this fact. Of course, people need to get around in all the ways, but until we make walking, biking, and transit more attractive and hopefully one day as attractive as driving, you know, we're going to see the same kind of things over and over. So they're really, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. And to your question or point, which I think is true many places, you know, people kind of say, oh, they shake their heads and say, oh, we're not New York. Absolutely. You know, nobody's that big in the U.S. Everything is scalable, though, everything. And I know we're really excited to be working with places like Charlotte, North Carolina, San Antonio, Texas, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Tampa, Florida is our newest Vision Zero city, which we're so excited about. And these are places with really different land use patterns. You know, they're not super dense like New York and huge transit systems. So they are going to look different, certainly. But I would say the foundations stay the same. And those are two major things. Number one, we have to be managing speed for safety. And that's what New York's doing. And that's what places like Sweden have done well. And when I say that, it really means how fast do we want people to go? We want them to be able to be at a speed that is not life-threatening, right? So to give an example, in a city, let's say a place like downtown Tampa or downtown Charlotte, people are walking and biking and they are waiting for the bus. We also have car traffic there, of course. So if those cars are moving at 20 miles per hour, 20 or 25 even, if they hit someone walking or biking, that is most likely a survivable crash for that person. But if that car is traveling at 40 miles per hour, which doesn't sound like that much, and a lot of our roads sadly are designed and posted for 40 miles per hour, that same person walking or biking is more likely to die. And it's a dramatic difference. So that 20 or 25 to 40 miles per hour is a big difference. So we really want to think about that. How are we setting our speeds? How are we enforcing? How are we designing roads for those safer speeds? So that's number one, managing speeds. And then number two, related and just kind of hit on there, is building roads that are really designed for everybody. So complete streets. So it's not a new concept. We know how to do this. How are we designating physically separated, comfortable, inviting space for people walking and biking. And I know we think a lot about the 8-year-old and the 80-year-old, right? So, you know, is it the hardcore cyclists, you know, that we're designing for? Sure, we want them to be comfortable too, but it's really about that 8-year-old, that 80-year-old. So would you feel safe with your child or your grandparent walking here and walking at maybe a slower pace across the street, potentially biking to a playground or to school? Those are the populations that we want to be designing for and welcoming for. And then everybody else in the middle is going to also feel more safe and comfortable. So I think we're seeing people do this, and not just in New York City. It's more suburban and lower density places doing it too.
You're listening to an interview with Pedal Power Promoters Christine Acosta and Vision Zero's Leah Shaham, recorded in October at the Vision Zero Cities Conference in New York City. We're going to take a real short break and get right back to that conversation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Let's get back to Christine Acosta's interview with Leah Shaham, the founder and director of Vision Zero.
I've heard you speak a lot about equity and equitable distribution of Vision Zero and safety dollars, roadway redesign. Tell us about what Vision Zero is doing now in the interest of equity.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that, because it's so important. And while this isn't a new issue, I think it's an issue that we're all paying more attention to, as we should be. As transportation advocates or professionals or people who just care about mobility issues or livability issues, we've got to understand how our work and these issues are absolutely linked to equity, particularly around racial equity, income, social equity. And I think some numbers that really stick with me that are really important to keep in mind is that nationally, and it's really disturbing but true, nationally we know that low-income people are twice as likely to be killed while walking in the U.S. We also know that African-American and Latino people in the U.S. are twice as likely to be killed while walking. We also know, kind of on the flip side, low-income neighborhoods are half as likely to have a complete sidewalk system. They're half as likely to have a complete dedicated bikeway system. They're half as likely to have great transit options. So you really look at that and go, okay, well, this makes sense now, right? And I think for any of us, particularly people living in a city, I know this is a case where I live in San Francisco. I see it here in Tampa. I see it in places like Durham and LA and Chicago. Over these past 50, 60 years, we've really built roadways and a lot of times freeways that cut through the heart of lower income communities and communities of color. And that's really disrupted communities in a lot of ways, but it's also sent a lot more fast moving traffic. And it's really created these physical environments that are less safe, less inviting. So it's not surprising that we have the results we have. We've built for this really, frankly, inequitable system. It's terrible. It's happened, you know, but the maybe positive part is we're recognizing this and we're realizing we can change this. We need to slow the traffic down, particularly in those areas. And I think something we can all do, whether it's called Vision Zero or not, is think about how do we dedicate limited resources? We only have so much funding. We only have so much staff time. We only have so much advocacy energy. How do we point that towards those communities that have been historically disinvested in or misinvested in, right? Underinvested in, et cetera. How do we go there and say, hey, you deserve more of the attention now because it has been so underserved over time. So working with the community then, engaging with the community to say, where do you think? Sure, we want to use the data, follow the data and say what needs to be improved, where are problems happening, but also ask them, what feels unsafe? It's just as important to match or to pair that qualitative information with the quantitative information. There's, you know, growing attention towards being data driven, which is very important, but we also need to make sure we're experientially driven, because sometimes when you look at that, we call it, you know, kind of the red dot map or the heat map of where severe injuries and fatalities are happening in your community. Again, you'll see a big cluster, unfortunately, around low income communities, communities of color, et cetera. But sometimes what's not showing up on those maps is where people want to be moving, especially walking and biking. And the environment is so undesirable and so daunting and so, you know, just distressing that people aren't walking and biking there. So right. How do we go out into the community and say, hey, show us where the dots aren't showing up, but where you would like to be walking and biking, and let's invest there.
There has been significant progress through various Vision Zero City work, but this is not a great year overall, both in the Vision Zero cities and nationally. So are you discouraged, or what are your thoughts about some of these numbers that are really hard to hear?
It is discouraging. We know that numbers were just released at the national level. So 2018 figures show that we are at a 10-year high nationally for pedestrian and bicyclist fatalities. And it's really deeply distressing. And it brings more urgency to our work than ever. I think what we're seeing is more of our maybe traditional kind of leaders in this area, groups like, you know, the engineering and planning world and public health world, are really looking at this and going, yeah, we have to change this. We have to do more, right? Of course we want more people walking and biking for their health, for the environment, for the economy. We really want more people walking and biking, yet we're not building for it. We're not designing for it. We're not encouraging and incentivizing it nearly fast enough. Now, of course, it's changing. Again, you know, in small pockets, we're having this change, certainly, and there's a lot of credit to go around, but we need to change it faster. So I think that's where we need the higher level systems change, right? This isn't just about, hey, let's pick at the edges a little. We need to make little improvements here and there, sure. But what we really need to be doing is saying systematically on a wide scale, hey, City of Tampa, Florida, hey, Denver, Colorado, hey, Seattle, Washington, do we want 45 mile per hour lanes running through the middle of a city? Absolutely not. Do we want 4-lane one-way roads, even if they're signed at 35, but people are going 40 or 45 down the middle of a neighborhood where we also have kids walking and biking to school? We want more kids walking and biking to school, et cetera. Those are really big changes we need to be making across the board. So we need to be proactive, not just reactive. Back to that map I mentioned, like, okay, where are the dots? Where have people been killed? Sure, we need to look at that. But we need to be proactive and say, maybe we haven't seen tremendous problems on this type of street, but we have on lots of other streets similar to this street, right? So a big, fast-moving road near a school. Not a good idea, right? But it's there. We got to deal with it. So how do we go in and now say, let's make safety improvements on all these types of streets and let's right size the roads? And might it take a minute and a half longer for your average driving commuter to get to work? It might. And that's a decision that I think a lot of us are looking at and going, I think we know the right way, right? A minute and a half longer, or even 3 minutes longer versus saving people's lives and encouraging safe, healthy mobility. That's going to be a no-brainer. So I think, you know, nationally the trends are frightening. And let me just say again, it's emphasize what the numbers are, almost 40,000 traffic deaths last year. That's about 100 people a day dying in preventable ways. That's distressing. The good news is we know generally how to prevent these. We know we have the toolbox, and the toolbox means slowing speeds down, adding more dedicated space for people walking and biking, making the distances shorter to cross for people walking, and really making our communities about walkability, livability, and connecting with each other versus just moving car traffic through faster. Right. So we're going to need to do things differently. And we are seeing when we do it differently, things change. So that's encouraging.
And I know you're working so hard at it. One of the things that I like to say about Vision Zero is improved public health. So can you tell us what roles your public health experts are playing in the various cities where they're engaged?
Absolutely. It's really great to see more collaboration between the health world and the typical transportation world, because this is not a transportation problem. It's been viewed as a transportation problem or issue for a long time, but with 40,000 traffic deaths a year, that's on par nationally with the opioid crisis, with gun violence, with so many other issues that are considered true public health crises. Yet transportation or mobility hasn't been traditionally. So I think that's something we need to shift. We need to be talking about it more as a public health crisis, because it is. And by the way, that 40,000 I'm citing, that's just deaths. That's not you know, severe injuries. And it's not also the injuries and fatalities we're seeing down the road from lack of physical activity and from unsafe, climate. Obviously, this, you know, everything we do with transportation, transportation is the biggest climate change kind of, you know, problem out there, right? Even more so than many other issues that get more attention. So how are we linking these things together? And it's going to take leadership. We need the public health folks there. You know, we need people acknowledging, hey, this isn't just an engineering problem. It can't just be an enforcement problem. It needs to be something where we're really looking upstream at who makes rules, right? So looking to your electeds, to your leaders of departments and saying, hey, public health department in my county, are you involved with this? Do you have a Safe Routes to School program yet? Do you have a bike-friendly business program yet? Are you at the table with the transportation planners and the police when they're working on transportation issues? Because you need to be. You know, it's not just – if we want to get ahead of this and say, hey, let's not be treating people on the back end at the hospital when they're either injured from a crash or maybe they are in there with diabetes or other health issues because they're not getting enough, you know, mobility and such, or people with asthma are feeling more bad and severe because the air is so, you know, polluted from more cars, et cetera. All those things can be predicted and prevented at the front end much more. So we need to really get proactive and say, hey, mayors of cities and city council members and state leaders, how are you going to invest your funds and invest your policies at these proactive, preventable issues so that we can be, you know, offering kids and seniors and everybody in between healthy, safe transportation options that really do benefit the community and their health?
Tell people how they can find out more about Vision Zero.
Absolutely. Check out visionzeronetwork.org, and there's a lot there in terms of resources. One thing we really want to do is not recreate the wheel. So Tampa can learn from Boston, which can learn from Portland, which can learn from Austin. We really are putting a lot out there about what's working, what's not, how to engage the community, how to measure progress. So visionzeronetwork.org is the place to go. And we are a nonprofit, so any support helps a lot.
Thank you so much. Thank you for spending time in our part of the world, which is Tampa, Florida, and with the Safe Routes National Conference. And we just could not be more delighted to host your visit. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Huge thanks to you. Honestly, we need folks like you out there asking these questions and pushing our leaders and getting the issues out there. And I'm so inspired by you. So thank you.
Thank you.
My thanks to Christine Acosta for sharing her conversation with Leah Shaham with us. If you are interested in Christina's work with helping businesses become more bicycle friendly, you can log on to pedalpowerpromoters.com. And for more information about Vision Zero, you can log on to visionzeronetwork.org. I'd also like to thank Leah Misbach-Day for catching us up on the good work that World Bicycle Relief is doing. And I wish Dieter Drake much luck as he slogs through all the minutiae of putting RAGBRAI 2020 together. A ride director's job is much harder than it looks. Thanks to all of you for listening. Won't you please take a moment to rate our podcast on your favorite app? You can also join the usually lively conversations that are going on at any time on our Facebook page. You could make a snarky remark on Twitter at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. Or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay warm, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.